This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And he's got a year. Edward Snowden has a whole year of freedom in Russia, granted 1 year yesterday by Vladimir Putin to leave Moscow's lovely airport and go anywhere he wants in Russia, knowing that when the year is up, he could face the wrath or indifference of the Russian government, who will then let him go to possibly face the wrath of the U.S. government, which would have had more than a year to figure out how to get him and what to do with the leaker, whistleblower, spy, saboteur, call him what you will. White House spokesman Jay Carney is already thinking about it.
We are extremely disappointed that the Russian government would take this step despite our very clear and lawful requests in public and in private to have Mr. Snowden expelled to the United States to face the charges against him.
But you're going to have to wait a year at least, Mr. Carney, a whole year in Russia. What would you do if you had a year in Russia, knowing you could face decades or even life in prison at the end of the whole thing? You'd probably start out on the Black Sea at one of Vladimir Putin's lavish dachas, hang with some oligarchs on their yachts, perhaps, not too far offshore, though, spend some time in historic Kiev. Oops, can't go there, it's in Ukraine now. You can visit beautiful St. Petersburg, though, and then possibly do a grand tour of some of the immortal shrines to freedom in Russia. Suppose you could visit the old KGB HQ in Moscow.
Do not be alarmed, my friend. We will make you as comfortable as possible.
They have some lovely basement rooms where you can vanish, never to be heard from again, I hear. There's a whole network of Cold War prisons to wander through. And then, for the real freedom fighters and Nobel Prize winners like Andrei Sakharov and Alexander Solzhenitsyn, there are the fabulous gulags to visit. Siberia, Yakutsk, the Arctic. Grab a hammer and crush some rocks. Hard labor never hurt anyone. A year of freedom for Edward Snowden. Well, his dad Lon seems excited about it anyway.
I would also like to thank President Vladimir Putin and the Russian government for the, what I believe, the courage and the strength and conviction to keep my son safe. Like any mother or father who loves their child, I love my son.
Lon Snowden, father of NSA leaker Ed Snowden, talking to Russian television earlier this week. But Russia's decision to allow Snowden to stay in the country, even for a year, has soured relations with the U.S. Joining me from Moscow is Stephen Lee Myers, Moscow bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Stephen, welcome back to The Takeaway.
It's good to be here.
So, Stephen, how are the Russians sort of greeting this news that Snowden is free to be amongst them? He's not exactly an Andrei Sakharov character among Russians at this point.
Well, you know, it's interesting that popularly, I think he is seen as something of a dissident who's, you know, exposed the surveillance programs of the United States and, you know, in a way that, you know, a lot of people here support, as some do elsewhere around the world, even in America.
So he could have a pretty good time in Russia over the next year.
You know, it's interesting. His lawyer just said this afternoon that, in fact, you know, he's still quite concerned about his situation. You know, I don't think he's going to live in luxurious exile here exactly because his legal fate is very much uncertain. You know, he's right now not in hiding, but he's certainly not in a public place. And he's, you know, found a place to live here, apparently. But it's not like he's going to have a very open existence in Russia, at least for the time being.
As far as U.S.-Russian relations are concerned, this will demand some response, do you think? Is that the expectation at the G8 meeting and meetings already on the agenda, on the calendar for Vladimir Putin and President Obama?
Well, I mean, I think certainly the reaction in Washington yesterday was furious, and there are many people calling for all manner of retaliation against Russia, beginning with the question which the White House has already looking at, of whether or not President Obama should go ahead with a meeting with President Putin, which had been scheduled in Moscow next month after the G20 meeting that's coming up in St. Petersburg. I think it seems pretty certain that that meeting won't happen and that they'll keep some distance from Putin. You know, I mean, the fact is that Russia and the United States have a lot they have to work on together, regardless of whether or not relations are good. And I think that will probably continue. But there's no question that this has really put a chill in the relationship. And, I mean, I don't think it's the only dispute between the two countries right now. They disagree on a lot of things, from Syria to nuclear weapons and Iran and so forth. but it was clearly not a gesture that was appreciated in Washington.
Stephen Lee Myers, Moscow Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And with us from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington is the organization's Vice President for Studies, Andrew Weiss. Mr. Weiss served as Russia advisor for Presidents Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush. Andrew Weiss, welcome.
Great to be here.
Has Vladimir Putin painted himself into a corner, or does he really have a play here? It's hard to know how constructive this would be either for Putin, just thinking from his point of view, or U.S.-Russian relations.
I think there's no question that the Russians were trying to get a very quick hit, big propaganda coup by welcoming Edward Snowden, and then it basically blew up in their face. When the U.S. began its pressure campaign and basically cut off the escape routes to South America and other places that might have welcomed Edward Snowden, I think the Russians really realized at that point they had miscalculated. I don't think they wanted this guy permanently on their soil, but that's basically where they ended up.
So they're just buying time with a year, and this whole problem will fester during that year, may get worse, and will certainly be back to haunt us in 12 months.
I really wouldn't focus on the 12-month clock here. I think that's something that's mandated by the way the Russian asylum process works. It's not a magic number. Obviously, if the Russians could wave a magic wand tomorrow and have him exit Russia and go to another country like Venezuela, they'd be all too happy to facilitate that. The practical question is, can you do it? And at this point, it doesn't look that easy. Based on what happened to Bolivian President Evo Morales' plane, a lot of people, I think, are not going to be willing to run the risk of aiding and abetting a fugitive's escape from the U.S. justice system.
Does this in any sense take the pressure off of Barack Obama to try to get concessions out of Vladimir Putin regarding Syria, a much more serious and difficult problem facing U.S.-Russian relations, and the nuclear issues that Stephen Lee Myers talked about a moment ago?
Well, I think Steve's right. You know, the U.S.-Russian relationship was deeply troubled before the whole Snowden mess erupted. And in some ways, we now see this outpouring of emotion on what has already been a pretty gloomy picture. But at the same time, you know, the U.S. is not rushing to get involved in the Syria crisis. The U.S. has kept its distance under President Obama pretty fastidiously for the past 2 years. What we're hoping for is for the Russians to help facilitate some kind of political solution. The burden to promote that political solution really falls almost entirely on U.S. shoulders, because if you remember, the Syrian opposition is deeply divided. They've been losing on the battlefield. You know, the Russian piece of this is actually pretty small, and I don't think we should pretend that the Russians have any kind of magic leverage over Bashar al-Assad. Assad sees himself as being in a fight to the death. It's an existential struggle for him, and he's been completely ruthless in how he's prosecuted the war.
So what would you make of retaliatory gestures such as canceling a meeting after the G20 meeting in St. Petersburg, or just, you know, not even making eye contact at the G20 meeting, those kinds of things, which we expect to see over the next couple of weeks?
Well, I think the White House has taken a close look at what its options are. But, you know, the options aren't great. And I think everyone needs to remember that, you know, we're dealing with a very different Russia than the Russia we had either 20 years ago in the early 90s when the country was completely weakened by the post-Soviet collapse, or the Russia we were dealing with in 2008 when the U.S.-Russian relations totally collapsed under President Bush. Back then, in 2008, there were no channels. There was no effective cooperation on anything. But right now, if you look at it, we have some important issues we're working on together. We're working on Iran together. We're working on what happens in Afghanistan after 2014. We're working on the counterterrorism questions. We're working on nuclear stability. So, you know, the question is, can you find a way to demonstrate your displeasure but not make Snowden a single issue litmus test that blows up the whole relationship? And I think the White House is trying to walk that line.
Finally, given your knowledge of history, but not meaning to be flip, there are monuments to a sense of lack of history and lack of seriousness regarding freedom of speech in Russia that Ed Snowden, who is now a champion of freedom of speech and small government not surveilling its citizens, he might learn from. Do you consider there's a certain irony here that Edward Snowden is in a land that is not known for, you know, keeping its hands off of its own citizens regarding surveillance?
Well, I think it's really unfortunate that the people who've been sort of doing the color commentary on this drama haven't really focused on exactly how complicated the situation is inside Russia when it comes to free speech, comes to political activism, comes to the ability to criticize the government. And so what, you know, what I think we really see is a modus vivendi between the WikiLeaks organization and the Russian government, where WikiLeaks trains its focus on governments like the United States and gives countries like Russia a free pass. And I think that's shaped a lot of the public reaction here. But, you know, for Vladimir Putin to be running around calling people, you know, guardians of freedom or, you know, human rights activists and all that, you know, hear it coming out of his lips, it is pretty ironic because those are not people he likes to hang out with.
Andrew Weiss served as a Russia advisor for Presidents Clinton and George H.W. Bush. He's the organization, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace's vice president for studies. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So a 7.4% unemployment rate. We're inching back to pre-2008 levels. Is it a flashback for you? Are we back to easy times? Tell me. From Fort Lauderdale, Florida, absolutely not. I currently have a Bachelor's of Science in Economics, and I'm working on my Master's in International Economics. Finding a job is not easy. Unfortunately, it seems as if a Bachelor's is equivalent to a high school diploma these days. Leslie on Facebook, yes, things are better. I looked for work most of last year and didn't even get one interview. I finally found a job this May. Miami is not Minot, though, says one of you from Florida. No, it is not easier to get a job today. I have recently had no luck. I have a master's degree, extensive work experience, have applied for at least 10 jobs over the past 3 months, and have not been offered even one of them. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to weigh in with your story. Here's another economic story. When Barack Obama was fighting tooth and nail for a second term back in 2012, he loved to talk about the bailout of the bankrupt auto industry as one of the government's greatest successes.
I believe in American workers. I believe in this American industry. And now the American auto industry has come roaring back, and GM's number one again.
What is good for General Motors apparently doesn't apply to the city of Detroit, which in July entered its own $18 billion bankruptcy, a record for a U.S. city. There is no talk in the White House and Congress of bailing out Detroit, the way the government bailed out AIG, which, by the way, reported better than expected profits today, or the way it bailed out GM. That contradiction and the fact that no one is really paying any attention to it is making lawmaker Dan Kildee, a Democratic congressman from Flint, Michigan, absolutely furious. Congressman Kildee, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, John.
We can bail out insurance companies, banks, auto companies. We can campaign about that, but bailing out an actual city, forget about it.
Yeah, and I think this is a sort of a sad commentary on the state of our politics, but also on the lack of understanding of America's cities and the contribution that they have and should make to our economy. When we talk about the support, I think, that cities need, this is only in our national interest. It's not an act of charity that I would suggest or some sort of gift, but this is simply protecting our national interest the same way we were protecting our interests when we rescue the auto industry or, you know, other important institutions. It's not just Detroit. There's a whole subset of American cities, older industrial cities especially, that are at serious risk. And if we don't take action, we will pay a price as a nation and as a society.
And oddly, it seems to me the charity model might apply more to the bailouts of some of these companies where bondholders who took a risk get made whole. And they're not people who we would necessarily associate with the economic engines of the U.S.
That's right. I mean, in the case of a city is an essential entity. It's an essential institution in a metropolitan area, in a region. And I think these older industrial cities are essential. They're not going away, unlike bankruptcy in a corporation where the corporation itself could be liquidated. Its parts could be sold off and it could be reconstituted or not under a different form. In a case of a city, we don't have a choice of making that place just go away. It will be there. Whether or not it goes through bankruptcy, like in the case of Detroit, there will be 700,000 people living in that place. And for, as some have suggested, the federal government to simply sit in the on the sidelines and be an observer as this city goes through what could be a wrenching process for millions of people, I don't think lives up to the responsibility that we have as a national government. So the form that some assistance might take, I think more likely takes the form of the existing help that the federal government has provided to regions, to metropolitan areas. What I would suggest is that we simply concentrate that help much the same way we have concentrated assistance to regions or to cities that have experienced overnight a catastrophe such as a hurricane, an earthquake, fires, whatever it might be. Detroit has experienced what we've referred to as a slow motion Katrina.
You know, as someone who represents Flint, Michigan, a place that's associated with an economic cratering of its own, you know of what you speak. You do speak from a certain experience here. When you have this conversation on Capitol Hill, do lawmakers just kind of roll their eyes at you and go, nice idea, please, I've got to get to lunch now? I mean, are you really fighting against a complete indifference on the Hill, bipartisan indifference?
There's a lot of indifference. I think you put your finger on it. And that really, unfortunately, covers the political spectrum, because a lot of folks see this situation through their own lens or through their own experience. Unless you represent one of these older industrial cities and have seen how federal policy, or in some cases state policy, over the decades have contributed to the hollowing out of these cities, you don't really understand that we actually have a role in this. And of course, folks, when they think about bankruptcy, they have a perception that bankruptcy itself is a solution to a problem, when really all it is a process that brings order to what would otherwise be a more chaotic situation. So, yeah, we've got a tall hill to climb.
But how do you deal with the argument? I think a lot of people will be thinking this as they listen to you talk, that the federal government bailing out Detroit ends up being a reward for the politics of former Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, that basically the corruption of Detroit gets rewarded by the federal government coming, and now every city can go, you know, there's always going to be a plan B.
Well, I think only if we decide that policy is some sort of morality play and that we punish an entire region for the misdeeds of a couple of bad actors. I think the other thing is that that impression implies that Mayor Kilpatrick himself was solely responsible for the failure of Detroit. He contributed to it for sure, no question about that. But there's no way that a single mayor for just a term or two can turn around the economic fortunes of a city whose decline began in 1950. That's when Detroit's peak population hit, 1950. So we've had this long period fueled by suburbanization, fueled by racial avoidance, fueled by a housing policy and transportation policy that accommodated the relocation of wealth and economic activity out of these cities into metros, or national trade policy that accommodated the relocation of really strong industrial jobs overseas or into Mexico. It's pretty hard to hold one individual who served a very brief period of time responsible for the collapse of that city when so many other factors contributed to it.
Congressman Dan Kildee, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Dan Kildee is a Democratic congressman representing Michigan's 5th District.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation.
One more economic story. It comes down to a single trader, folks, the only person held directly liable for any of the excesses of the financial crisis that nearly brought down the entire global economy. The reason why your mortgage might be worth more than your house. It's all due to a guy named Fabrice Torres. The former Goldman Sachs Golden Boy trader and 34-year-old Stanford graduate was found liable yesterday for 6 of the 7 civil securities fraud charges facing him. He had been accused of misleading investors about securities that he knew would fail. Torres could now face fines or a complete ban from Wall Street. That will be determined in later proceedings. In a response that might be loosely translated as yippee, Goldman issued a short statement: "As a firm, we remain focused on being more transparent, more accountable, and more responsive to the needs of our clients." Yippee might be unfair there, but let's talk with DealBook reporter Michael De La Merced, who joins me now from the New York Times newsroom. Michael, welcome.
Hi, John.
It's a fab Fabrice, not so fab today, we understand, yes?
That's probably fair to say. The jury found him liable, not guilty, because this was a civil trial, on 6 of 7 counts of fraud. They spared him the most serious charge, which was that he had intentionally and knowingly made a misleading statement, but otherwise found him liable on everything else.
Is he an outlier? Is that what this says here? And the government is claiming victory.
The government's definitely claiming victory, but he is pretty much the only person that I can recall who has been found liable in a case related to the financial crisis that was brought by the government.
In terms of, and again, I don't want you to speculate about sort of cultural issues, but I mean, in the way that he behaved, in the testimony that came out at trial, is he an absolute sort of rogue outlier here, or is the kind of behavior that he exhibited here typical, characteristic, statistically likely at other brokerage houses and other banks?
So one of the funny things that came out in trial is his defense argued that what he was doing was basically following industry standards and that what he had done was pretty much the norm. You had some of his former colleagues at Goldman who had said, yeah, if I'd known the information that he had withheld, it wouldn't have made a bit of difference. I wouldn't have changed anything that I had done. This is all pretty much the way that we operated at the time. But what the government argued is that he went above and beyond withholding a crucial bit of information about a particular investment. But what a lot of what he had done was essentially following industry practices, at least according to his lawyers.
Is there a follow-on effect here? The liability of Fabrice Tor suggests there might be other people who could be targets of civil lawsuits outside of the SEC bringing these charges?
Well, I think that's definitely possible. I think that a lot of people will feel emboldened to launch their own lawsuits in the wake of this. Of course, Fabrice is probably going to appeal, and that'll take a little bit of time. But I think that there's some fodder now for other people to claim that they too had been ripped off by what had happened here.
Part of this is about the rehab of the SEC, which is trying to recast itself as a more aggressive regulator here. How do they do on that front?
I think that they can definitely claim victory here. They were very aggressive at trial. They pretty much accused Mr. Tour of leading a web of deceit and trickery that managed to make people lose millions of dollars. So they're going to claim that this is a sign that they really have been emboldened, that they are an aggressive regulator, and you know whether that's actually true remains to be seen.
Michael De La Merced, reporter for The Deal Book with our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Liability of Fabrice Tour, the bailout of Detroit, or is it easier to get a job this year than last year? We'd love to hear from you on all this. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Tell us a story. Are you having a better time or a harder time trying to get a job in 2013?
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Movie time. It's Friday, and we welcome Rafer Guzman, who's movie critic for Newsday, Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. They both are the host and co-host or co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John.
So we got a couple of movies to talk about. One is sort of an interesting process story about Hollywood. We'll get to that in a second. But let's begin with an attempt by Denzel Washington, it appears, and Mark Wahlberg to start a new franchise. The movie released Two Guns. Listen.
You want to talk about it?
No.
You sure?
Yeah, I'm sure.
I told you I didn't like her, man.
Shut up.
What are you getting mad at me for?
Because you talk too much.
What I ever do to you?
Besides shoot me?
You know what you are? No, you're a misanthrope.
It's misanthrope.
I'm a misanthrope. Did you know what I meant to say?
No, what did you mean to say?
That you don't like people.
Shut up.
Two Guns, Wahlberg and Denzel Washington. What do you think, Rafer? Is this a franchise?
I don't know if it's a franchise. You know, they basically play two small-time hoods who they don't – each does not realize that the other is a undercover agent. Denzel's with the DEA. Wahlberg is with Naval Intelligence. This is a pretty typical film, pretty lightweight action comedy, the usual banter you heard there. Kind of funny, not really hilarious exactly. I think what this film really does is set some very low expectations for itself and then just barely clears it.
And Kristen?
I had no idea what was going on during most of this movie. In addition to the secret identities, you have all sorts of convoluted situations that pop up again and again where people who you think are on this side of the law are actually on this side. I'm double-crossing you, you're double-crossing me. At one point, I just felt like I was watching a foreign movie with the subtitles turned off. But
not that there's anything wrong with that.
But I will say a great testament to the chemistry between Denzel Washington and Marky Mark is that I still enjoyed those two.
It's not Marky Mark. He's Mark Wahlberg. You're going to get in trouble with his agent if you say Marky Mark, child of the 80s. But these, let me defend pop culture for a moment. These franchises are worth billions. Listen.
Shut up! Yes or no? You want to die?
Yes or no?
I got the job done. What the hell do you want?
You didn't answer the question.
Oh, what do you want to hear, man? Do you want to hear that sometimes I think about eating a bullet? Huh? Well, I do.
Come on.
Lethal Weapon.
Lethal Weapon, yes. Right, Danny Glover. Two G's, right? Glover and Gibson.
And Gibson, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They could use some rehab, both of them, in terms of their careers. But Lethal Weapon was worth billions.
Sure.
Does this have a chance?
I think these two, I think if you didn't have these two great top-notch stars in the roles, you wouldn't give this movie the time of day. It's got a pretty lazy script. It's pretty energetically directed, but it's also, as Kristen was saying, a very discombobulated film. Whether it turns into a franchise, I don't know.
If it survives, it's because of them, the actors.
Yes. I would love
yes.
to see them do something else together. They're terrific together.
All right, well, that's interesting. All right, our next movie?
I mean, I love her. Better, she's gorgeous. But it's more fun to keep it a little complicated.
Complicated?
Christian, what are you doing? Where are you going with this?
Just being transparent, baby.
From The Canyons, Paul Schrader's latest movie, the making of which was chronicled on a blog that was actually picked up by the New York Times and elsewhere. What do you make of Lindsay Lohan's latest, Kristen?
Well, I have to say Lindsay Lohan is so overshadowed in this movie by James Dean, the porn superstar. He just acts circles around her. I would watch him do anything after this movie. She looks like she's still trying to kind of get herself together again. It's too bad. I'd really love to see her acting well again.
Why did you say I would watch James Dean do anything, Kristen? Why did you do that? Why did you do that on our program? Why? Rafer, what's your sense of The Canyons?
Well, I think this was supposed to be one of these out-of-the-box, unorthodox movies. You know, a weird recurring role for Lindsay Lohan. She goes topless. Supposed to be daring and brave. I don't think it works. It feels really amateurish to me. And I love Paul Schrader, the director, but I just didn't think this movie worked. It's actually really dull, and for all the sex that's in it, it's really unsexy film.
And the making of it, the crowdsourcing of it, the sort of unusual way it came to be, any comment on that?
That's probably the most interesting part of the whole movie,
yeah.
I would say. It's a fascinating story. Just it's Kickstarter funded. They cast it with people who applied online. It was really a fascinating story.
And Lindsay Lohan actually picked up a paycheck.
$100 a day.
Exactly. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, co-host of the Movie Date podcast, along with Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks,
thank you, John.
Coming up, we'll talk with director Paul Schrader. Stay with us.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no.
What is the story with film director Paul Schrader and Lindsay Lohan? They pioneered a form of rehab, you might say, that even intrigues the land of the Betty Ford Clinic Hollywood. The Canyons, written by Bret Easton Ellis and directed by Schrader, does not describe a place for drying out from substance abuse. It's a new film for a star who can't get an insurance policy from a studio and a director who can't get a studio budget.
What are you doing?
I was just looking for my phone.
Did you find it?
Christian, yes.
Why
is my phone in your drawer? Yeah, Christian, why was...
Find it!
Christian, why was my phone...
I know about you and Ryan! I trusted you, and you lied to me! You lied!
Please.
A portrait of the aimless Hollywood youth culture. The making of The Canyons is a story in itself of the power of social media, crowdsourced funding, and a film that, despite all the difficulties in making it, says director Paul Schrader, still wanted to be born.
We just set out to explore the new paradigm. We had both been frustrated by films falling apart, and I just said to Brett, you write it, I'll direct it, we'll pay for it. And we did for the first time for me, you know, the way it was conceived and financed and cast and made and promoted and now released was all through social media. We raised money on Kickstarter, we cast on Let It Cast, and it opens on August 2nd, you know, through all the VOD platforms.
Lindsay Lohan, why did she want to do this? What was the collaboration like?
Well, we had offered her a a cameo, and she read the script and said, I don't want to play the smaller role. I'd like to play the lead. Because of her public difficulties, it's hard for her to work because she can't get insured. And but that didn't matter to us because
right.
we weren't going to use insurance anyway because it was our own money. And if you can't take a chance with your own money, when can you take a chance? So, you know, Brett and Braxton Pope and I each had about $30,000 in this plus the Kickstarter money. And, you know, if Lindsay had gotten arrested or something, we would have just lost that money. And it seemed like a good chance for us to take, you know, because she really does have that magic thing, that thing that, you know, you can't take your eyes off from her. And she is a our partner. She owns 1/4 of the film. So, you know, she made the film for $100 a day because that's what we were doing. But she'll get and already has gotten a $250,000 deferment, and she's a quarter owner of the movie. So she, you know, she will be made whole quite nicely.
You also cast James Dean, the porn star, in this film. I'm wondering, who was it easier to get to do the sex scenes that the script required, James Dean or Lindsay Lohan?
Well, the sex scenes, you know, were nothing beyond what would be normal in an R-rated film. So it's not an explicit film that way.
Right.
The shooting of the sex scenes was very wearing on Lindsay, primarily because James had brought along a couple of his friends because it was a scene with four people in it. And you know, this is the first time she was doing a scene like this, and they do this for a living. And to them, it was a lark, you know. It says, you know, let's do a sex scene without any sex in it. You know, how what a goof that will be. And for her, she was terrified. So it was, you know, a stressful evening.
And will she work with you again, do you think?
Well, I'd love to work with her again. You know, I mean, she's got more important things to do right now. You know, she's got to rebuild her reputation as a reliable performer. And, you know, she's taken a few years to get this unreliable reputation. It's probably taken another year to get rid of it, you know, and we're all hoping she can.
You described that this story is about something you refer to as the post-porn generation. Explain.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm a generation away from Brett. Brett's a generation away from these kids in the movie. I couldn't really write about these kids, but Brett knows about them. It's, you know, kind of about the hookup generation of Blender and Grindr. And kids who were raised in the sea of readily accessible pornography and of social media. And, you know, that changes one's psychological ecosystem.
And your ecosystem began in Western Michigan. We both grew up in the same town, Grand Rapids, Michigan. You went to a Christian Reformed high school. I was in maybe the slightly more secular but still very conservative East Grand Rapids, the suburb. You've done a number of stories that are about growing up in a repressed sexual environment and breaking out of that. In many ways, this is a culmination of a lot of issues that you've been dealing with for your entire career.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of strange. It doesn't feel like an old guy movie to me. It feels like very much a movie of this moment. You know, I described this film to the cast when we had our first reading. I said, this is a story about some 20-something Angelenos who went to a movie. And the theater closed, but they stayed in line because they had nowhere else to go. And that kind of generation, these kids who are making movies but really don't care about movies that much, and kids who are hooking up but don't seem to care about hooking up that much. My generation was, you know, let's change the world. Brett's generation was, let's make some money. And this generation is, to some degree, let's make some money but not have any fun.
Sounds fascinating. What's the next gig for Paul Schrader?
I'm going to do something with Nicolas Cage that hasn't been announced yet. So that will be a more conventional kind of independent film.
Paul Schrader, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Paul Schrader is the director of the new film The Canyons, which is in limited release, available through video on demand today. Try to make me go to rehab.
one more look at rehab in a serious way. In an age where the mentally ill are not warehoused away in secure institutions, the question of how people who require sustained mental health care are to live in our communities is complicated. The mentally ill are simultaneously people with civil rights, medical needs, and the potential to harm the people around them. Kendra's law was passed by New York State as a response to the death of Kendra Webdale in 1999, who was pushed to her death on a New York subway platform by a diagnosed and untreated schizophrenic man. 44 other states have issued similar laws that require the severely mentally ill living independently to be given mandatory outpatient treatment as a condition of their independence. The law has been a godsend for a mom named Margaret who has struggled for years with her own schizophrenic son.
He came down with severe psychosis when he was 20, and when he was originally hospitalized, there was incidents of violence, and I was told, the system is broken. Number two, you will never get your son back. Number three, in America, you have the right to wander the streets insane if you so choose.
Margaret, who is concerned enough about her son being identified as unstable and having his tentative rehabilitation set back that she doesn't want us to use her last name, says the assisted outpatient treatment approach of Kendra's law has problems like weak enforcement, but she supports it as a lifeline. And a study of the AOT strategy in practice suggests it has been an effective alternative to hospitalization or letting people simply spiral out of control. With us along with our mom, Margaret, to discuss all this is Dr. Paul Applebaum, director of the Division of Law, Ethics, and Psychiatry at Columbia University's Medical School.
Well, the data, as you know, John, show that patients who are placed on a Kendra's Law outpatient commitment status have fewer hospitalizations, more utilization of outpatient services, are less likely to get arrested, and less likely to end up homeless. So the intervention seems fairly successful from almost any perspective. It also saves a good deal of money compared with simply allowing people to cycle in and out of hospitals and jails, which is typically what they've been doing before being placed on Kendra's Law. The seeming paradox that all of this happens despite relatively weak enforcement powers may have two explanations. One is that when somebody is designated as eligible for assisted outpatient treatment and a court order is issued, in a sense, it commits the system to the patient as much as it commits the patient to the system. That is, this person moves to the top of everybody's list of people needing attention, and they are much less likely to fall through the cracks. The second factor here is one that may work on the patient's side of the equation. For many patients, it's very difficult, understandably difficult, to acknowledge that they have a severe mental illness, one that's likely to be with them for the rest of their lives. Under outpatient commitment, they don't need to do that. They can shift responsibility to the judge who told them that they had to take treatment without necessarily acknowledging their own need for that treatment. And that difference, which may sound like a slim one, actually may be just enough to get over the hurdle of the person's involvement with needed treatment.
Well, you've outlined a kind of third category here, or a third pathway. We certainly all understand what inpatient therapy is for people who are severely mentally ill. That option is not available for everybody. And partly because of deinstitutionalization, we've discovered that the criminal justice system has become something of a dumping ground or an inappropriate sort of destination point for people with severe mental illness. This outpatient program is really a third way. Is that how it functions, Paul?
I think that's right. It's important to recognize that it's not for everybody, and it's not a replacement for the availability of good outpatient services, which I think is what many of its opponents fear. But when used for the appropriate group and when sufficient resources are provided in addition to the statutory power to commit to provide the necessary services, it can be a very useful adjunct to the mental health system.
Margaret, would your son understand the importance of this program in the way that you do? Would he consider the outpatient monitoring a burden, or would he embrace it?
Well, I'm sure that he would rather be living on the street with bloody feet than living at home, eating, having a girlfriend, being functional, having nobody even know that he's severely mentally ill, and even having a chance if he keeps on with the program of going to school. It's only lucky that he didn't run away somewhere where we could not bring him home.
So how are things going right now, Margaret?
Well, it's been a struggle, and I've worked very, very hard to get where we are now. And if I saw it, you know, if I saw it falling away to nothing, because it's a catch-22. If you look well and you appear to be well, you no longer qualify. So, yeah, that could happen. I don't know when, but for now, I'm just extremely grateful and relieved.
We'll keep our fingers crossed there. Margaret, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Paul Applebaum, give us some sense that the safety net for people like Margaret is really in place because of this law, or does it need to be changed in some way to maybe reassure her a little bit more than I can hear in her voice?
Well, I understand her fears that her son will relapse to where he was before Kendra's law was applied to him. I guess we can say two things, John. One is that there is good evidence to suggest that even after people come off a Kendra's law commitment, they continue to stay out of the hospital, to take their medications, to have a reduced rate of involvement with the police. The other thing to say is we need more research in this area, because one important question that we don't know the answer to is how long is the right period of time for somebody to be on Kendra's law. At present, as Margaret indicated, when somebody's been doing well for a year or perhaps two, the treaters are uncertain as to whether that means he's doing so well he doesn't need outpatient commitment anymore, or he's only doing well because of it and it's a reason to continue.
Paul Applebaum, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Paul Applebaum is director of the Division of Law, Ethics, and Psychiatry at Columbia University's Medical School. And Margaret, hang in there. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak about this in public.
We'd love your stories, of course, on anything that relates to that conversation or anything else that's going on in the program. Earlier this hour, we talked about the job numbers that were released today, 162,000 jobs added in the month of July. Fewer than expected. We're asking you, is it easier to find a job this year than it was last year at this time? From Oklahoma City, I personally have had more luck than last year when I just graduated. I obtained a new position in which I'm actually using what I learned through my degree in college. Very thankful for that. From Ocala, Florida, yes, it is easier enough so that I quit my job without having another lined up and found one in a reasonable time. Good luck to both of those listeners in Oklahoma City and Ocala, Florida. We'd love your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend, folks. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.